AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. A 37-year-old woman and four children, the youngest just one, have been stabbed to death in a residence in Brooklyn. New York City police say they have a person of interest in custody. In Phoenix, four people were found shot to death in one apartment, and police say the suspected shooter killed himself in another. Police in Indiana University have lifted an alert, saying students are no longer at risk following a stabbing at a campus apartment complex early this morning. IU Bloomington police say the victim is being treated at the university hospital after being stabbed in the back during a fight. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie says federal red tape has been the cause of delays in getting aid to homeowners a year after Hurricane Sandy. AP Radio's Jackie Quinn reports.
Governor Chris Christie, who became an icon of last year's freak storm with his blue pullover, understands the frustration over slow relief efforts, but says don't blame his administration. Christie says Congress took 3 months to approve the $50 billion relief package, and it includes a thicket of red tape designed to prevent fraud. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Boston Red Sox manager John Farrell and more than a few Red Sox fans are not happy with the way last night's World Series Game 3 ended, with an obstruction call against third baseman Will Middleton, allowing Alan Craig to score the game-winning run in the 5-4 St. Louis Cardinal victory.
Will's trying to dive inside to stop the throw. I don't know how he gets out of the way when he's lying on the ground. And when Craig trips over him, I guess by the letter of the rule, you could say it's obstruction, but I don't know. Like I said, that's a tough pill to swallow.
The Cardinals have a 2-1 lead ahead of tonight's game 4 in St. Louis in that best-of-7 series. If it's a victory by the Red Sox, they go back to Boston for game 5. This is AP Radio News. The operator of a ride at the North Carolina State Fair has been arrested and charged with 3 counts of assault with a deadly weapon after 5 people were hurt in the ride on Thursday.
We have determined that this ride was tampered with after the inspection.
Wake County Sheriff Donnie Harrison says critical safety devices were compromised on the Vortex. An Emmy-winning actress voiced one of the characters of The Simpsons has died.
In the 70s, Marcia Wallace played the office secretary on The Bob Newhart Show. Starting in the 90s, she was the voice of Bart Simpson's teacher, Mrs. Krabappel, on The Simpsons.
I was shocked and stunned.
Harry Shearer provides many of the voices on The Simpsons.
Marcia was always joyful loved being there and loved working with us and brought this huge positive energy to the place.
Executive producer Al Jean says Marcia Wallace's death is a terrible loss.
That's the AP's Ed Donahue reporting. I'm Tim McGuire, AP.
Google scans every single picture that you upload to Google Plus. What it does, it learns what your family members look like. It groups photos of your family members together. It can tell if your subjects are smiling. So if you've got a subject smiling in 3 photos, and 1 photo they've got their eyes closed and are frowning, it will take the face from a good photo and paste it into the bad photo so everybody's smiling.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
Hey, Mom, why is the sky blue? Why don't animals talk? Why do dogs have wet noses? Why is an 11 pronounced 1-2-1?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
Why do I have a belly button?
But you don't have to know every answer.
Why is the ocean salty?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
Why are there 50 states?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
Why is pizza round?
They just need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Hey there, everybody. It's David and Nikki Nellis for Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show.
Next Sunday, October 27th, we'll be talking with the Chew's Jason Roberts. He's coming to the Metropolitan Cooking and Entertaining Show. And Kara Newman. She is the spirits editor for the Wine Enthusiast. She's also the author of Cocktails for a Crowd.
That's Foodie and the Beast next Sunday and every Sunday at 11 right here on 1500 AM.
The odds of becoming a signed artist and having 3 number one albums? 1 in 100 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of this performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 88. I'm Toni Braxton, and I encourage you to learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. And today's show is sponsored by Bernhardt Wealth Management, serving as your personal chief financial officer, helping to make work optional. We have a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Sean McDermott, the CEO of Windward IT Solutions, Gordon Davidson, the president and CEO of Micronic Technologies, Bill Jaffe, the EVP and general manager of Tape Technical Project Engineering, and finally, Gary Fuller, a partner with Tate, Bywater, and Fuller. First up is Sean McDermott, the CEO of Windward IT Solutions. What is Windward IT Solutions, Sean?
Nice to be here, Peter. Windward IT Solutions is a niche consulting firm that focuses on the design, build, helping companies design, build, and manage large-scale data centers and networks, global networks. So most of our work is done in the commercial sectors, telecommunications, financial services, and also in the defense department.
So for people that aren't familiar with what a data center is, what is a data center?
A data center is a giant building, anywhere from 15,000 to 100,000 square feet, full of racks of computers as far as you can see.
And why do people want to put their stuff there as opposed to in their own closets?
The companies that we work with manage 15,000 to 40,000 servers. So when you're talking about banks, like the largest bank in the world is one of our customers, they have multiple data centers, each one with tens of thousands of servers that are doing banking transactions and loan transactions and all kinds of things. So there's requirements for security and uptime and power and things like that. So they tend to build their own data centers.
How old is the company?
We were founded in 1997, so we're 16 years old.
And how big or small are you guys today?
We're about 125 people today.
Why start the business?
I started the business because I worked for another consulting company. I was an associate there. And I had ideas on how we could do things there, and it seemed to me that that wasn't the place to do it. So I consciously made a decision to go off and do it myself.
And is this your first shot at entrepreneurialism?
This is my first company. I've actually formed four companies, three more since then.
Oh, you have?
Yeah.
What was the biggest surprise when you came out of the security of a pretty good-sized consulting firm into the brand-new startup?
I was surprised how hard it was. I get a lot of people over the years who've asked me advice, and they all seem to think, I'm just going to start my own company. It's a very difficult thing, and there's a tremendous amount of unknowns you learn along the way, and challenges that you meet. Things don't work out the way you think they're going to. All best laid plans are completely demolished when you start the company.
So give us an example, if you don't mind, of a curveball that found you early in the startup.
Well, I'll give you my first curveball is when I went to start the company, and I recruited a bunch of people, and we formed a company, did about 4 months worth of diligence. Then everybody resigned, and the company was officially started. And the next day, two people unresigned, happened to be two key people, and that was the end of the company. So that was my first attempt. And a year later, we did it again, and we actually got it off the ground.
How'd you finance it?
I financed it through credit cards.
What was that experience like?
Stressful.
Yeah.
Very stressful.
And you had a lot going on in your personal life, I understand, at the time you decided to start a company.
I did. Yeah, my wife was, we were trying to have a child. My wife was finally, got pregnant. So we were very early on in pregnancy.
So what were you thinking?
Probably not much. I think you look back over the years and the decisions you made, and there's just so many decisions that you make by the gut. And it just felt like the right time. And you get determined and you say, I can do this, and you convince people to join you. And,
but isn't that what you'd want some kid that's listening to the show to actually take away from this interview is pay attention to your gut. It's almost always right.
I would actually highly reinforce that statement. I think that even recently, even now, you know, we make decisions and as a team, and if it just doesn't feel right, there's something that is nagging at you when you walk out of that room with an executive team that we've made a decision. You say, it just does not feel right. And if it doesn't feel right, you got to go back in the room and figure it out.
Uh-huh. When did you first learn that lesson?
You know, I think I learned that lesson as a kid. And, you know, all the jobs I'd done over time and the projects I was giving when I used to work at the government and the projects I got when I was at a consulting organization, you just learn it over time that, you know, your gut is usually right. There's something in your subconscious telling you that you missed something.
Yeah. Where are you from?
I am from Bowie, Maryland. I grew up in.
Mom and Dad, what were they doing growing up?
My mom was a housewife. She was actually an interior decorator, kind of on and off. And my father was a government employee for National Security Agency.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have two sisters and one brother.
And where are you in the order?
I am the youngest.
What's it like being the youngest of four?
Now, as we're all older, you know, we're all pretty much the same age. You know, we're a pretty tight group age-wise. It kind of blends away. I think as a kid, I don't know what it was like. I can't remember. I mean, it was a long time ago.
What do you remember most about your childhood that kind of shaped who you are today, looking back on it?
I think, you know, probably one of... We were a family of working people. You know, as I said, my father was a government employee, but all the kids worked. You know, my brothers, my sisters, we all worked at young ages. So... We were
because you
up.
Had to, or it was kind of like the expectation?
No, I think it was the expectation, or it was just the culture. Mm-hmm. You know, it was the culture of our family. And I think that, you know, it was a pretty interesting time when I was in my teens, when my father retired from NSA and bought a company, actually started a handyman service. So he was an entrepreneur, and that didn't work out. And then he bought a business in Annapolis and ran that for a couple of years, and that didn't work out. So I got to see firsthand. I think, you know, my dad's heart, he was an entrepreneur. It just never really worked out that way.
Yeah. Other than your parents, what are some significant role models?
You know, I'd say my only role model really is my dad. You know, I don't kind of get enamored by...
Where'd you learn to run a business?
I learned it probably myself, you know, and just paying attention to other things. I learned a lot at this consulting company. While in the end I decided it wasn't a place for me to stay, they provided tremendous training, tremendous opportunities. They taught me how to run projects. That was probably a defining point in my career, is to really pay attention to what's going on around you and learn.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier the culture of your family. What's the culture of your business like?
You know, business culture changes, and we're in the midst of a transformation right now. And the culture where...
Why does business culture change?
Because the company changes. The companies are like children. You know, they
is it because of size or life cycle of company? What causes culture to change?
The people caused culture to change. The management changes. When I started Windward in 97, we were all young. You know, I was 30. I was 29. I was actually one of the youngest guys on the team, even though it was my company. Now that team... You know, we all have kids. We have kids in high school. Your priorities change. So when people's priorities change, their outlook on life changes and the culture changes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for me, it's how do you continue to redefine the company? You know, I think it's a metaphor of life of as you go through life, how do you continue to re-look at, you know, what do I want my life to be today? What was it? Was very different than what I wanted to be when I was 20.
Would you say that's the one thing that the CEO can do that nobody else can do is keep that definition current and fresh?
I think so. I think that the CEO's job is really to plant a vision and build a team around that to execute on that vision and really help people explain why we're doing it. And I think that's one thing that a lot of people don't understand is the perception of the CEO and what we're trying to do may be very different than the people who actually have to do it. And my motivation for doing something may not actually translate to my mid-management team or even my general staff that work there. So you have to really understand why are people there and why are people part of the team.
How do you spend the bulk of your day today in the role of CEO?
I spend probably half of my time in sales-related activities. I'm very much out in front of customers and partners. I try to spend a lot of time mentoring my staff, and I don't mean mentoring like they need help on how to grow as a person. Mentoring them in the context of the vision of what we're trying to do. I spend a lot of time. Right now, we're in all our planning processes for the next year, and we're in a very interesting time of our company, how to take it to the next level, so I'm spending a lot of time there.
In order to take the company to the next level, what do you recognize you have to be different about as the leader of the business? Where's your growth edge?
My growth edge is really in redefining what we're going to do and investing in the team to get us there. Mm-hmm. I have a very, very competent management team, and my time is well spent of setting clear direction and giving them the tools and autonomy to execute on that vision, and then kind of standing out of the way and right. letting them do it.
What would you say your proudest moment up till now is?
My kids.
How about your most difficult accomplishment?
My kids. Yeah, that was a loaded question, wasn't it? I think in the end, I'm not going to be remembered for Windward, you know, and it's not going to be on my tombstone. My legacy is my kids and my family and the lessons I give them and the lessons I learned from my parents and my dad.
Sure. What's the website address, Sean?
It is windwardits.com, windwardits.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Sean McDermott, who's the CEO of Windward IT Solutions. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, for more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back right after this business phone call. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your business spotlight. Joining us today is Bob Dingell, who is the managing director of Pierce Capital Partners. What is Pierce Capital Partners, Bob?
Well, Peter, it's a small boutique M&A firm for all practical purposes. We focus on working with small companies, mostly IT government contractors, and prepare them for kind of a mid-market acquisition. In other words, these are small companies that have decided for whatever reason it's time to either merge with someone else or sell.
What makes you guys so unique in your space?
Well, we spend a lot of time working with the companies to maximize value. We go overboard because many times it's similar to selling a house. You don't decide on a Friday you're going to put your house on the market on Monday. So we spend time with these founders and owners to get maximum value for their companies.
And what do you like most about this position?
Well, you know, I've been there and done that, so I can relate one-on-one experiences to these founders and owners.
So you just help an entrepreneur who's worked really hard get their business to a stage, and then they exit, right?
They exit. And, you know, many entrepreneurs, keep in mind, take companies to a certain stage, and that's what they like doing. They don't want to manage it and grow it into the mega millions.
Thank you. How can someone reach you?
Oh, easily by either going to our website, which is piercecapitalpartners.com, or directly. We have a cell number there, or office number, 571-934-6131.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Bob Dingell, who's the managing director of Pierce Capital Partners. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and that was your business spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, and today's show is brought to you by Bernhardt Wealth Management, serving as your personal chief financial officer and helping make work optional for you. Joining us for this segment is a young man by the name of Gordon Davidson, who's the president and CEO of Micronic Technologies. What is Micronic Technologies, Gordon?
Well, thanks, Peter. It's great to be here. Micronic Technologies, we have a technology that can treat and clean all sorts of different kinds of industrial water that serves humanitarian needs. It was designed and originated to help humanitarian efforts, but we found there's also industrial applications. It's an extraordinary technology that I think was going to really change the game.
And when was the company founded?
The company was founded in 2008 by Karen Sorber and Kelly Raw. Kelly's the inventor of this tornado technology. It's very unique. There's nothing else like it in the world.
Are these guys physicists or what? I mean,
Kelly is an inventor. He's a savant. He has about 22 patents to his name. He's just one of those guys. And Karen and he are married, and they wanted to bring this new tornado technology to the world. Mm-hmm. And so they formed the company. And then I had a relationship developed with them about a year and a half ago. I was a mentor to the company in something called the Clean Tech Open. And we formed a great relationship, and Karen asked me to come in and run the company. Yeah.
Yeah. And why do you feel you're the ideal pick to do this at this point in time?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons why it's a good fit. One, I'm very used to startups and the difficulties and the heartaches and the perseverance and all the things that are required in building a new company.
Oh, come on. Starting companies, I hear, is just all kinds of fun and never a dull moment.
Right, and you get plenty of sleep.
And yeah, that and make boku money, right?
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. So it's all
that's
sorts
not
of
true.
Fun.
You're,
no.
You're here to tell you that's not true.
Right, I'm here to tell you some reality. One, I have the startup experience, and that's very important. Two, I've helped build several companies that were successful that involved raising capital.
What do you think the key to a successful startup is?
Well, it's the key to a successful startup, there's several. First of all, it comes back and always comes back to the people and the quality of the people.
Not the product.
No, people come first, and you've got you can have a great product with an open marketplace, and if you have the wrong people, forget about it. It's not going to happen.
Right.
So you've got to have the right people in the right place doing the right things, and then you look at the product, and then you look at the marketplace. All the pieces need to fit together.
So in the early days of starting a company, give us an example of what the right person looks like to you.
Well, again, it's got to be no person has it all. So you've got to identify the different skill sets that you need for the different roles in the company and also for different times in the company. Mm. And so there's no cookie-cutter approach to this. For example, we just brought on a guy who we've had some needs on the financial engineering side, so we brought in a part-time CFO who's fulfilling that role very well. We have brought on a PhD mechanical and environmental engineer who's serving his role on the research side. It's putting the right people in the right places at the right time.
And resources are pretty scarce in startups typically. So how do you motivate someone to take the – that's a big bet, isn't it, for an employee to join?
Well, it's a big bet. You know, people are putting, in some cases, virtually everything they have on the line.
Right.
And so the one thing that you need to provide people need to be bought into the vision. They need to understand where the company wants to go, and they need to understand what the risks are. And so they make an informed decision about whether or not they're going to join it. But ultimately, it's going to come down to confidence and leadership.
So how long have you been doing the entrepreneurial thing?
Oh, well, I hate to tell you, but close to 30 years.
Now, go back to about 39?
Yeah, that close, pretty much.
So you started when you were 13, you were telling us in the green room. So take us all the way back to that.
Well, I mean, it's mother necessity and mother, what is that saying? Anyway, I forgot what it was. But if you have needs that need to be filled, and we had a good family, but we didn't have any money. And so I was tired of not having any money. So the first thing I did at the age of 13 was scrawled on a piece of cardboard, I'll hire out to do yard work and put it in the window of the local grocery store. And within a day, I got a call. And within a day, I was over there working, doing things I wasn't quite ready for. And as I told you earlier, you know, I got a little bit of money and I got a cold root beer. It was that cold root beer I remember more than the money.
So take us across time. It wasn't the first, that wasn't the last time you tried something new. Where else did that show up?
Well, it kind of showed up in just seemed to happen. I mean, maybe there's, if you're drawn to certain kinds of situations, they just sort of happen. I don't know. There's sort of a karma out there that's hard to understand sometimes. But you know, I continued to find opportunities when I was a young guy. I mean, one, just for example, in high school, this guy bought out a tin shop with all the original equipment from the 1700s and 1800s, and I was his first employee. So I became a tinsmith and a craftsman, when I was 16 years old. And that just happened, and it got me, I was working in high school and gave me a summer job. You look for it. if you need something, you got to fill the need.
Right.
And so I always was able to land on my feet.
Did you go to college?
Yeah, I went to college.
What'd you major in?
Biology.
Mm-hmm. Why biology?
Kept me outside. I liked it. I found it interesting. I liked political science actually the most, but I didn't figure that I was going to go anywhere with law school there, and I didn't want to go to law school. But the biology thing, I really enjoyed. It was I focused on aquatic and water, what it was.
Isn't that curious? Here you are all these years later, back right. in water.
Yeah, exactly. And so it was. It prepared me from a scientific perspective. I have pretty sound principles when I look at these things from a business perspective.
So you bring not just the entrepreneurial business piece of this, but you bring a scientific method way of thinking to as well?
Well, I would say that to some extent, yes. I'm more of a business guy now. I haven't been practicing the science too much. But if you look at all my two of my last companies, they were environmental-related companies that required looking at environmental risk, and a lot of it revolved around water. And so you were, you know, I had a lot of people working for me, engineers and scientists who did the day-to-day work, but you had to make business judgments often based on scientific information. So that degree and working in that milieu did prepare me better for these kinds of business arrangements.
If everything goes right and you hit it just out of the park, mm-hmm. where will this company be in 5 years?
This company will be huge and it will be global. The technology is that powerful and that versatile. What we would see within 5 years, about $100 million a year revenue, high margins, laying the groundwork for a lot larger launch pad. And given we're looking at the fracking, the wastewater, industrial wastewaters, it's global. Also looking because of the versatility, we can help humanitarian areas with creating fresh water. It's global.
Yeah.
The companies, our customers will be global.
You mentioned to us in the green room that faith has been an important part of your professional life.
Right.
In what way?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think if you look back, I did grow up going to church, and I didn't like it.
Yeah.
Okay? and so I didn't pay a lot of attention to that sort of thing for quite a while. But, you know, as you get older, I guess, or maybe just for me, as I went through some very, very difficult things in my life. And it puts you philosophically into perspective of looking at, you know, what is this all really all about? Why do people suffer? You know, why do people have to go through hard things, and how do they handle hard things? And so I was asking all these questions, and I've said in the green room, you know, there's sort of a toggle switch. People go through life, and they can direct themselves toward faith or not. There's really not much of a middle ground there, if you think about it. And so I found my faith, and it was the best decision I ever made.
I characterize it, and it's I relate personally to this, as you can go either better or bitter.
Yeah,
and you just decide I'm just going to make it better.
Yeah.
And so what do you suppose you refer to as a toggle switch? Do you remember the moment where, you know what, I'm just going to go this way?
I do. Yeah, it was in July of 2007.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's when I made a commitment.
Yeah. So how does that inform the way you lead a company?
Well, it informs it a lot, I hope. You know, I mean, nobody's perfect. I make mistakes. But when I look at the my company through this prism, and if you look at the basic principles, for example, that you'll find in the Bible, they're great principles for applying how you deal with people.
Right.
And really, again, I always, when I look at a company, I don't look at the widget in the first instance. I look at the people. And so you try to create a climate where it's positive. I mean, this is all positive stuff.
Right.
So that's how I look at it.
What's the toughest thing you've ever accomplished?
The toughest thing I've ever accomplished? Getting my family through a really bad situation over a six-year period was the toughest thing.
Yeah.
That was really difficult.
How about your proudest moment up till now?
My proudest moment? I hate to personalize things in that regard. I have to think about that.
Personally or professionally?
Well, I mean, same thing. I think the proudest moment is, you know what the proudest moment is?
What?
My last company, IES Corporation, we saw this little niche. We created this market. Our clients were Fortune 100 companies. We had a great run. I had four other partners. We were all equal partners. And the proudest moment was being part of that company and its success.
Great. What's the website address for Micronic Technologies?
Micronictechnologies.com.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. We've been speaking with Gordon Davidson, who's the president and CEO of Micronic Technologies. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, for more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight.
Are you really confident you've assembled the strongest team to work with you on your business? For example, an attorney who has successfully handled your type of problem, an accountant who sees the big picture, a business advisor who gets it, a real estate broker who really knows the market, a commercial insurance broker who really has access to all the different insurance products, an employee benefits guru who really helps mitigate future costs, a wealth manager who works with you to make work optional, an understandable information technology wizard, a commercial banker with minimal covenants, an investment banker who believes business is a relationship, not a transaction, a staffing specialist who can really help you build the team, even a confidential peer group with whom to compare notes. Listen to executiveleadersradio.com, that's executiveleadersradio.com, to confidently select a business leader who serves business leaders to help you, because nobody's interviewed more business leaders from Princeton through Northern Virginia than Executive Leaders Radio. So you'll have confidence in your choice of a business leader to help you in your business, in your ultimate selection of this business leader. This business leader can include your attorney, an accountant, a business advisor, a real estate professional, a commercial insurance agent, an employee benefit specialist, a wealth manager, an information technology guru, a commercial banker, an investment banker, a staffing specialist, a collection agency, even a CEO club. Save yourself grief, time, and money. Listen to executiveleadersradio.com. That's executiveleadersradio.com. So you can listen and learn from the most highly respected professionals. executiveleadersradio.com.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, and our show is brought to you today by Bernhardt Wealth Management, serving as your personal CFO, helping make work optional for you. Joining us for this segment is Bill Jaffe, who's the Executive Vice President and General Manager of a company called TAPE, Technical Project Engineering, LLC. What is that?
So TAPE is a government contractor specializing in the defense and homeland security space. We perform program management support, cybersecurity, and budget support, PPBE, and so forth.
So for people not familiar with the government contracting space, give us an example of the kinds of things you do.
So for the Army, we work with the Army training models, basically translating exercises, training exercises, and the cost of those training exercises into readiness for the soldiers. How well can they shoot their weapons, operate as a team, work together in a large group organization, communicate back and forth.
So that allows the Army to be more efficient with their training programs?
Correct.
And make for better readiness, I'm guessing, huh?
Exactly. And also hopefully save money in the
Absolutely.
Long run. We manage for the Army about a $16 to $20 billion budget.
When was the company founded?
2003, we incorporated, but 2004 opened for business in the first of the year.
And how big or small are you guys today?
A little under 200 people. We just finished an acquisition for an Orlando company doing training, modeling, and simulation.
So you're in the government contracting space. What's the last 15 days been like for you?
Yeah, you know, I tell you, it's been an interesting process. Fortunately, in the defense sector, it's been a little bit better. The contractors are not as we didn't have as many furloughs, but we did have some.
Yeah, but nobody starts a business predicting this kind of volatility and uncertainty. Nope. How do you handle that as a business owner?
Well, you know, we were talking about this beforehand. What'd you call it? The VUCA.
VUCA. VUCA. Volatility, right. Uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity.
That's us.
You feeling any of that lately?
We are feeling a lot of uncertainty, and we're certainly feeling some volatility. But, you manage. Our employees did have some accumulated leave. It turned out that our training, planning time was set up for this particular period, so we were going to have people come in and work in the office as
yeah.
well,
but
and
that's
so
the,
we did.
That's the tactical answer. I mean, everybody has a plan B, but what is it about? This is, to me, when these things come up, I see it as a leadership opportunity.
Well, we have to work with our employees. We have to make sure that each of them understands that we are in business and that we have a profit motive. But right. on the other hand, we want to make sure that they're taken care of. As you know, they've signed now at this point to go back, but only the feds will be fully paid. Our
right.
folks will not be paid. Those that
it's
were
gotta
off
be tough.
And on leave.
It's got to be tough.
Yeah, it is.
So what's it like to be a business owner, care about your employees, and watch them suffer through something like this?
You know, it didn't enhance my sleep patterns, I'll
yeah.
say that. On the other hand, I've been through a lot of this. I mean, I was here for 9/11. I was here for a number of the other circumstances that have occurred to us, shutdowns and so on. As a business owner, we do the best we can, and we hope that we've set a culture and a process that people understand.
So with all these obstacles to running a business, why do it?
You know, I do it because we do it as a company. I mean, because my wife is the president and CEO.
Right.
We do it as a business because we love giving back. We are in this for a service opportunity. It's a continuation of what we did before
yeah.
For her, a continuation of
right.
her military service. And because we can help our own folks grow. We have three companies that have been formed out of our own senior staff.
Cool.
So we enjoy it.
Your wife and you started the company back in, when, 2004, right?
2004.
So
got
you're sitting
married
around
in 03.
No kidding.
Yep.
So you figured this is the way we'll do our honeymoon, start a company?
Well, we did our honeymoon in Las Vegas with Elvis, but, you know, yes, you're right. We did.
What is it about you guys that would do that?
I'm not sure I really know the answer to that.
You're sitting around the dining room table
yeah.
one day and say, you know, we're kind of bored. Instead of getting a hobby, let's start a company.
Well, I had had a lot of businesses during my growing up phase. The difference is that those businesses never made any money.
Oh.
My wife had a lot of businesses that she was in with her father over the years. Her businesses made money. So together, we are now in business together
making money. Well,
and
congratulations.
That was the difference for us.
So not all partnerships succeed and
nope.
add the additional complexity of being married. Why are you guys succeeding?
You know, Pete, it takes a lot of communication, and it takes a decision every morning to say, you know, I'm in this and I'm going to stay in this. I get up every morning. I want to go to work,
mm-hmm.
but I want to go to work because it's fun to do, but also because we have that communications. We work things out together. We are together in our overall approach to what we're doing, and we love doing it.
But you also said that you guys have come up on a couple of strategies that seem
mm-hmm.
to work. Give us one.
Okay. So one thing is we don't make the hard decisions at work. We make the hard decisions over dinner or at home in the quiet space.
So you slow it all down. Is that what you're
saying?
We
do. We do. Uh-huh. And the second thing is we don't, and this we talked about a little bit earlier, we don't actually make the decision right away if we can't agree.
Yeah. So what's the value of slowing it down? What have you learned? Because you do that, what does space provide for you?
So it isn't so much that there's space as in the adjustment is to acceptance. One of us is going to have to compromise.
Right.
And the process of compromise takes time
yeah.
and energy on the part of the person who's giving a little extra, perhaps.
Yeah.
And so we often have to let it sit. It doesn't mean that we don't discuss things, and sometimes vehemently, but when we're finished, we walk away, we let it sit, and then we move on and say, okay, now we can come to a decision.
Where are you from?
I was born in New York, but my dad was drafted into the Korean War. Loved the South so much that we moved to what we affectionately call the sixth borough, which was North Miami Beach. Yep. I was raised in New York. It just we had sun.
Do you have a memory of New York?
I don't. I did go back for various and sundry visits because we left relatives behind, but not much of one. But now my two stepdaughters are both there.
Uh-huh. So what do you remember most about your childhood?
I remember, actually, it's funny, my dad had two brothers, and he was a pediatrician. He took care of all the different, the kids and so forth and so on, but my dad's next youngest brother, the middle brother, had a business, and that's the thing that I remember. My granddad was a member of that business.
Everybody was in business.
Jaffe Stationers. No longer in business.
Were you in the business?
No, I was not. But my granddad was, and my
But you were watching and observing and learning.
I was.
What did you see?
What I saw was an entrepreneurial activity that worked for him, that worked for the people around him, that other people liked.
Say more about that. What does that mean, an entrepreneurial activity?
Well, okay, so when you're an entrepreneur, you're creating a space in which other people are employed, in which you're giving back to your community. My uncle really enjoyed being the face of Jaffe Stationers.
To the community.
And I enjoy being the face of technical and project engineering. I have a blog called The Fish Don't Jump in the Boat, and I help other companies to understand how to negotiate the federal marketplace.
Yeah. Where do you want to be in 5 years?
I want to be right here where I am right now. I might want to be behind there with your chair. But,
well, still running companies?
Still want to run the company. Yep. Love it.
What still makes it fun?
We are in the growth and expansion phase. We're working hard. And we're at that very, very volatile stage for small businesses in the federal community where we're about to graduate from being a small business and become a
big.
Now
you got to play with the big boys.
And we got to play with the big boys. You know, we go off the cliff and we stop playing with little guys and we start competing with Lockheed Martin.
So what adjustments do you feel you're going to have to make in the way that you lead?
That's an interesting point because that's why we talked about this. I'm an EVP now rather than the SVP. I moved over and took over the operations section. And we're beginning to remold the corporate entity in a way that will prepare us for that enterprise time when we're not a small business anymore.
So a recognition of what got us here won't get us there?
That is absolutely correct.
So how does one let go of the past when it got you here?
With many claw marks. It's just like anything else. You have to look at what works, let it go, and move on to something different.
What's your proudest moment up till now, Bill?
We talked about this as well. I have a bat in my office. It's one that actually my wife won for being one of the top 50 women entrepreneurs in the Washington area. And it's one of those things that has been a part of our common heritage that the company is there. I don't need the personal credit. I need the recognition that TAPE as an enterprise is growing and prospering, and that our employees are growing and prospering, and that our subcontractors and primes are growing and prospering, and that we are giving back to the community all at the same time.
Great. What's the website address?
The website is www.tape-llc.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Bill Jaffe, who's the EVP and General Manager of TAPE Technical Project Engineering. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, for more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is a gentleman by the name of Tom Williams, who's the Director of Business Development for Cordia Partners. What is Cordia Partners, Tom?
Thanks. Cordia Partners is an accounting firm. We don't do audit. We don't do tax work. We are simply operational accounting. We also do executive search for the hard-to-fill financial positions, CFOs, controllers, that kind of stuff.
What makes this company better than all the others, in your opinion?
Well, our business model is unique. Whether it's in a company's period of rapid growth, we're there to help companies expand. If firms are going through challenges during the recession, we help them optimize their internal accounting group, so we increase operational efficiency.
Yeah, so you play integral growth roles in growth.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you're in the role of business development. What do you like most about your job?
It's fun, first of all. I enjoy meeting CEOs, CFOs, and usually when we're talking, there's usually a problem. And my firm is an integral part of helping to solve that problem. So we have business solutions that they need. It's a nice marriage.
So you just like helping people solve their problems through the use of your company's expertise?
Yes. Great. Very well put.
How can someone get a hold of you guys?
We are www.CordiaPartners.com.
CordiaPartners.com.
Correct.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Tom Williams, who's the Director of Business Development for Cordia Partners. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and that's been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. And this show brought to you by Bernhardt Wealth Management, helping serve as your personal chief financial officer by making work optional. For this segment, we have Gary Fuller, who's a partner with Tate, Bywater, and Fuller. What is Tate, Bywater, and Fuller, Gary?
Tate, Bywater, and Fuller is a small to medium-sized law firm. We are located in Vienna, Virginia. The law firm has been established. It was established in 1971. I joined the firm in 1998 and have been was made a partner of the firm in 2005. We have about 8 attorneys and 25 total staff members. We practice in various areas of law, including criminal litigation, civil litigation, white-collar crime. We also do personal injury work, estate planning, bankruptcy, real estate. And those are the main general areas.
Yeah. And so 8 attorneys. Mm-hmm. Isn't that – that's a small firm. How do you manage to stay relevant in a town like this with such a big law firm?
Well, we focus on those areas, and we're very good. We'd like to think that we're very good at those areas. And so – and we're also very agreeable to referring out business. If a client comes to us and it's not one of the services that we provide, we have very good recommendations that we can make. When we've been in the area for as long as we have very good relationships with other law firms.
Mm-hmm. What type of law do you practice?
I personally practice real estate law and bankruptcy law and also have a fairly substantial business practice.
Uh-huh. Why that area of law? What makes that intriguing to you?
Well, I've always liked real estate law, and right out of law school, I knew in my mind that that is what I wanted to do. I find it to be fascinating. I find it one of the reasons I did that is because it's happy law, I like to say.
Happy law?
Happy law.
What does that mean?
What that means is that you are helping people to acquire something that they really want.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know how many real estate transactions I've conducted personally, but it's well over 5,000 in my career so far. I haven't even counted them, but I can't tell you how many times you have a young couple that has just purchased their very first home, and the fact that they are so excited and so happy to have achieved this milestone, it's very satisfying.
Yeah. Have you always known you wanted to be a lawyer?
I have. Ever since an early age.
So tell us about it.
Well, my first exposure to an attorney was when I was about 10 years old, and it actually was completely related to real estate law. My parents were in the process of adopting my little sister, and I remember going to his office. I remember meeting him, and I remember just the feeling of this is someone that's important. This is someone that really has, you know, is going to help someone. And the thing that really sticks with me was the fact that there were some issues with the adoption, but the fact that he was able to accomplish this and the happiness that he brought to my parents, I thought this is really something that is worthwhile.
So that's interesting for a 10-year-old to observe all that. Mm-hmm. Is that a part of who you are, this guy that really can observe?
Well, I like to think so. In fact, that's one of the reasons that I followed up and did go into law, because I like to watch people. Mm-hmm. And I came across several other attorneys, you know, as I was growing up, and got to know quite a few of them. In fact, Doug Bywater, my law partner, I've known Doug since I was probably about 13 or 14 years old. He's a bit older than I am, and certainly someone that I admire, and that was one of the reasons why I was excited to join the firm in 98.
So, and you're from this area, is that right?
I am. Well, we moved out here in about 75. In Great Falls, and my parents still live there.
What, you tell a great story about the house your parents still live in. What is it?
Well, when we moved out here, my father announced that, family, we are going to build a house. And I came to find out that what that meant was actually building a house from the ground up. The only thing that we contracted out was someone to come out and dig the hole.
And how old were you?
I was 13 at the time.
So you're swinging a hammer building a house, the very house you're going to live in.
I was laying concrete footings. I was laying cinder block. I was doing framing.
You'd never done this before?
I'd never done it before.
What was that experience like?
It was hard. It was very hard. It was when a lot of my friends were out, hanging out or watching TV or what have you, I was out working at the house, doing these kinds of things.
Looking back on it, though, how did that shape you?
I think it really taught me how to work. It taught me the importance of starting a task and completing a task. And it really taught me the importance of completing a task well and really putting yourself into a task. I think that has paid tremendous dividends. Not only that, but I'm somewhat handy around the house.
Yeah, I'll bet you are now. How has the practice of law changed since you started?
It has changed. First of all, I believe there's a bit more competition, but I think the computers have really changed the practice of law. When I first started out, there were not all these sources of information that people had. They really needed to go to an attorney to get information. Now you go online, but there's also a downside to that, and that is that when people call me and ask me specifically about real estate, but actually more so about bankruptcy, there's so much bad information out there and misinformation. It's almost doing people a disservice. So a lot of times what I spend my time doing is basically dispelling some of the notions that they have that they've gleaned from the internet when they call me.
Mm. I've also read that a lot of law work is being offshored.
It is. Some of the law work that is fairly simple, straightforward. That's being offshored. We haven't had too much as far as.
Does that concern you, though? The very notion of that kind of thing.
Well, I think that you lose some of the personal touch of being a lawyer, and that's what I really like about it. When I'm doing real estate work, as I mentioned to you, bringing people or assisting people in acquiring the things that they've worked so hard to gain, that to me is very satisfying. But in the bankruptcy context, it's a very personal thing. I do a fair amount of consumer bankruptcy work, and you are really delving into and dealing with people's serious problems that they have. And I cannot imagine doing that kind of work without a face-to-face interaction.
Mm-hmm. And you've started up another side company in addition to the practice of law. Tell us about that.
Yes. When I first joined the law firm, I started a title company by the name of Equittitle.
Why?
Because I wanted to do real estate in a larger scale. The law firm up to that time had been doing some real estate transactional work, but large, a little bit here, a little bit there. And so one of the things that I wanted to do was to start up a company that was solely dedicated to that. And it dovetails and segues nicely with the mm-hmm. law firm practice.
So it hasn't been just roses. We've had a few recessions the way, right?
Oh, no. No, it was difficult. In fact, when I started the company, I named it, hired the staff, had to get all the licensure and everything like that. You're right. It was a very slow start. But I think timing, as they say, is everything. And we were in business for a couple of years, and then the boom started. And so it was a wonderful time to be in the title business.
Yeah. What's the last 5 years been like?
Last 5 years have been it's gotten a bit better. But from 2007 till about a year or so ago, it's been tough. It's been very tough.
What's it like to lead a business through a tough time like that?
It's very difficult. What you do is you learn to prize your certain employees. I mean, there are certain people that work for me that are just amazing and indispensable, and you learn to really work to hang on to them and to keep them happy and to keep them satisfied.
What were you like as a kid, other than handy with a hammer?
Well, my dad says I'm a bit of a troublemaker, but he always describes me as a good kid, always on the edge, but a good kid.
What's always on the edge mean?
What that means, always pushing the envelope just a little bit, not enough to get into trouble, not uh-huh. enough to anything serious.
Well, what does that mean, though? Were you just wanting to test the limits of things, or what?
A bit. I grew up in a very conservative home. My parents are LDS. I'm LDS. And so there were certain guidelines, and I think it's natural natural for a teenage young man to want to push those limits sometimes. But like I said, never too far.
Other than your parents, tell us about some important role models and mentors along the way.
Well, when I was because I had some skills as a from building the house, when my friends were flipping burgers, I was always working as an apprentice or working on construction projects. And there was a gentleman that I knew that was a very well-to-do, self-made millionaire from real estate development, and he would hire me for his crews. And he told me something that I'll never forget. He told me that once you work for yourself, you'll never go back. That was the phrase that rings in my ears to this day, and I've taken that advice. And it's been good advice. And what I would do I would form my own. This was going back to my college days. I would come home in the summertime, and then I would form a construction company, and we would build decks for about 3 months until we went back to college. There were two or three other similar people to myself that did that, and we would form it. We would probably build 20 or 30 decks during the summer, and then we would go back to school. So we were able to use those skills to make quite a bit of money.
What'd you do with the money?
Well, a lot of it went to college. A lot of it was blown on dating, having fun, with my friends. But I did save most of it for college purposes.
Were there some significant events that maybe have shaped you? I know that one scene with the lawyer at 10. Mm-hmm. For some people, it was the civil rights movement. For some people, it was other things. Was there something like that that came along that helped shape who you are today?
You know, I don't think that there was one single moment. I've been very blessed. I come from a very stable family with mm-hmm. a mother and father, always had employment. I don't think that there was one thing that shaped me. It's been many things over many years that I believe has shaped me. And a lot of it has to do with the strong family that I come from, the stable family that I come from. I believe that's probably it.
What's your proudest moment up till now, Gary?
My proudest moment? The fact that my son can throw an 80-mile-an-hour fastball. No.
You're pretty proud.
I am very proud. I have four children, and my youngest is a boy, and that was a very, very proud moment. But no, I'm being somewhat facetious on that. Probably one of my proudest moments is when the law firm has been successful. There's no question about it. But when you see a company that you start from scratch pretty much by yourself – and are able to build it into something that is very successful, and that's a very, very proud moment.
Great. What's the website address?
The website address is TateBywater.com.
TateBywater.com.
Yes.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Gary Fuller, who's a partner with the law firm of Tate, Bywater, and Fuller. We've had a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Sean McDermott, who is the CEO of Wimmert IT Solutions, Gordon Davidson, the president of Micronic Technologies, Bill Jaffe, the Executive Vice President and General Manager of Tate Technical Project Engineering, and finally, Gary Fuller, a partner with Tate, Bywater, and Fuller. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for without you, we wouldn't have a radio show. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
The March of Dimes and AFSEA Nova invite you to the 13th annual Heroines in Technology Gala. This event will honor women who exemplify leadership and are making a difference in our community. From CEOs to rising stars, this year's finalists will be recognized for their significant volunteer contributions at a Black Tie Awards presentation on Friday, November 8th. Heroines in Technology is sponsored by Harris Corporation. All proceeds will benefit the March of Dimes mission to give all babies a healthy start in life. Since 2001, the event has given awards to 73 heroines and raised more than $1.4 million to support the March of Dimes. To learn more about the March of Dimes and to get your tickets to Heroines in Technology, visit marchofdimes.com/metrodc. That's marchofdimes.com/metrodc. And help celebrate the March of Dimes' 75th anniversary.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and Federal News Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not.